The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Coming up on the program today, my 2001 interview with Joyce Johnson for her book, Door Wide Open, A Beat Love Affair in Letters, 1957 to 1958.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today my guest is Joyce Johnson. Her book, which just came out in paperback, is called Door Wide Open, A Beat Love Affair in Letters, 1957-1958, and it has an introduction and commentary by Joyce, as well as quite a few letters, many of them written by Joyce to Jack Kerouac and by Jack Kerouac to Joyce. Welcome to the program.
I'm delighted to be here.
This book was a gift from heaven in a way, wasn't it? You probably never thought you'd see some of these letters again. Tell us how it all came about.
Well, I never imagined that those letters had survived, because the ones that I wrote to Jack. I had kept Jack's letters, but my own, at the time that I knew him, he was always moving around. And so I was amazed when 2 years ago, John Sampas, the executor of the Kerouac estate, told me that he'd found all my letters in Kerouac's archives. It turned out that Jack really kept everything that was ever sent to him. And he often went to these archives, to refresh his memory when he was writing a book.
And this was a man who did this despite the fact that he traveled light quite a bit of the time.
Traveled very light, yeah. Just had a little zipper bag with a few things in it.
So he somehow managed to preserve all of these because they were important to him.
Yeah.
Joyce, I understand that you met Jack, you were introduced by a mutual friend, Allen Ginsberg.
That's right. Yes, it was a blind date. I don't know, when people think of Allen Ginsberg, they don't think of him as someone who arranges blind dates. But in this case, he and Jack had just come back to New York from San Francisco, and Jack didn't have a girlfriend and was staying in a kind of a beat hotel on 8th Street. And so Allen told him about me. And one night when I was visiting the apartment where Allen was staying with a friend of mine named Elise Cowan, the phone rang, and Allen said, "Someone wants to speak to you." And it was Jack. And he said, yeah, he'd heard I was nice, and he'd like to meet me right away, in fact, and would I come down to the Village and to Howard Johnson's there. And he'd be waiting at the counter in a red and black check shirt. So down I went. I already had heard quite a lot about him. I was very interested in him from what I heard, and I had also loved his first. I had read his first novel just a few months before, and I had really thought it was terrific. I'd been very moved by it, so I was primed to meet him.
The fact that you were familiar with him is more indicative of your interest in his writing than the fact that he was well-known, because at that point
he wasn't well-known.
Right. No. He was laboring in obscurity.
Yes, I mean, he had just gotten word that On the Road was going to be published that fall. It was in January of 57 that I met him. But for 7 years, no one had been publishing his stuff, since his first novel, which was a much more conventional book than the ones that followed. And he'd been desperately poor and often living the life of a homeless person. It'd been a very, very hard struggle. So people were beginning to hear about him again because of a lot of publicity that the first reading of Howl had gotten in San Francisco. There were beginning to be articles about the San Francisco Renaissance, but his name was by no means a household word. And he had absolutely no idea, when I met him, of the kind of success and fame that he would achieve with On the Road. It was just, it would have been unimaginable for him. I think I've always felt that what he really wanted, he would have been quite content with a kind of modest but very literary success, with people praising his style and so on. He didn't really have any desire whatsoever to become a culture hero.
It's a fascinating book to read because you have these wonderfully insightful insertions between the letters where you kind of bring us up to speed on what's going on. And then as we read your letters, yours and Jack's, we see a lot of development, a lot of changes, a lot of transitions in the way that you write and the way that you speak to one another. It's really intriguing.
Yeah, you do see a development there, yeah.
What was your first impression of him when you first met him?
That he seemed more vivid to me immediately than anyone else I'd ever seen. He just seemed very larger than life somehow. No one in New York looked like him. He looked like he'd come right down off a mountain. He had a lot of vitality and charm, and he was also weary and somewhat melancholy. And he told me he had just spent 63 days in solitude on Desolation Peak in Washington and sort of wished he were back there, you know, now. And he was also funny, you know. I remember riding back uptown with him on the subway, and he was sort of imitating Harpo Marx and making faces at me. He was an amazing guy.
Now, this period that he spent up there in isolation, you describe him as really having a hard time with this. He was up there for a lot of different
63
reasons.
63 days, yeah. He was there to, you know, he wanted to sort of dry himself out. He'd been drinking a lot. He'd been very depressed. And he practically cracked up there. It was actually a terrible experience for him in many ways. And he wrote about it later in Desolation Angels. The sad thing was Jack always had this dream that he could solve everything if he wanted to by pulling back from the world and going away and being a hermit. But that didn't work for him, and really nothing worked for him.
This Jack Kerouac that you meet, he's older than you.
Yeah, he was 35, I was 21.
And he's got some miles on him. You, however, are someone who's trying to break away from the parental bonds.
Right, right. I had just broken away from them very recently. I was out of my own apartment. I had a job in publishing, and my independence was very important to me. But I also longed to travel and have adventures. You know, I was writing. I knew a writer had to have experience. And that was one of the great attractions of Jack, this person who had done so many things and been to so many places. And Jack took a great interest in me as a writer and was always encouraging me to change my life completely and follow his example and go on the road. But that was not something that would have been very easy for a young woman to do.
This is a wonderful look at that time and this so-called Beat Generation. It's also a great look at what it was like to be a young woman in the 1950s. As we read your letters, as we read his letters back, you're always so forgiving. You're always so caring. You're always waiting, hoping, praying that this man will somehow come around.
That's right. yes. I had a series of big disappointments with Jack. He would, you know, say, come and meet me in Berkeley, and then he'd change his mind about it because he couldn't be in any place for very long. He'd, you know, the bad vibrations would inevitably set in and he'd move on. And if he was happiest, it was, I think, moving between destinations when he could imagine what it would be like when he arrived, but it never lived up to his imaginings. So I made many preparations to join him at different places, first in Berkeley, then in Mexico City. I even had my plane ticket. But all I achieved in terms of my own travels was to move from the Columbia University neighborhood downtown to the East Village. That was as far as I got. But yet that was a significant journey because it was a very interesting time to be there.
it's heartbreaking for the reader as we're reading these letters, and it had to have been heartbreaking for you when he says, okay, come out and see me in California, come out and see me in Mexico City. And then you just know at a certain point when you've made a certain emotional response to him in a letter that he's going to send a letter back with all these excuses and all these explanations for why you shouldn't go.
Right, right.
It's just it became almost like a pattern.
Yeah, it was a pattern, definitely.
Well, it was really something to read because after the California thing, when he did it in Mexico, I was expecting that. And then I think he did it again in Florida.
Yes, well, the Florida thing was a much more iffy situation because he really did want me to come because he was lonely there. But on the other hand, he was living with his mother. She was, you know, he kept going back to her, and she didn't want any woman around.
Let's talk about her.
Mm-hmm.
You met her.
I did meet her. I met her once. Yeah, by that time it was several months after the publication of On the Road, and Jack had earned some money, and so he had promised his father, always promised his father, that he would buy his mother a house. So he finally bought her one with most of the money he'd earned out in Northport, Long Island, which was about an hour and a half from New York. And finally he invited me out there one weekend. And when I got out there, ma mère met me at the door and said, what train are you going back on? I definitely wasn't welcome. Living with Mamere seemed to be a very bad situation for Jack, and he seemed to be drinking heavily, more heavily than ever, even though he thought he would have a quiet life with his mother and get away from, you know, all the pressures of being a celebrity. It seemed that something quite the opposite was happening.
She seems like a classic enabler.
Yeah. Well, she was a drinker herself. Mm-hmm. Jack's whole family, you know, his father, his mother, they were drinkers. Might have been born with alcohol in his blood, you know, predisposition.
Another thing that comes out in the letters is the guy has no money. You're not rich, but you work and you make money doing these different jobs at different publishing houses and et cetera. And the conversations about money, like the $225 he borrows from Allen Ginsberg. I mean, this just, the stuff, it goes on, and no one ever forgets about the money.
Right, right. Well, he always paid his debts. You know, if he borrowed $30 from me, I'd get it back. I lent him the money to come to New York for the publication of On the Road. He didn't have any, I sent him $30 so he could take the bus. Recently, as perhaps you know, the scroll of On the Road was sold for $2.43 million. And it seemed to me such a terrible irony, all that money, and thinking, you know, what a struggle Jack had always had. Because all he ever achieved for a while was a lower middle class lifestyle, you know, the last 10 years of his life. But when he died, he'd been broke for quite a long time because his books went out of fashion, and he really hadn't been making money for a while. So,
and then, of course, the books started selling like crazy.
And then the books started selling, mm-hmm. Yeah. On the Road now sells, I think, 100,000 copies a year.
The scroll, if I recall, hadn't it been damaged in some odd way?
Well, around the time Jack wrote it, his friend Lucian Carr had a dog.
Right.
Who ate the last few feet of it, I believe.
Right.
But the scroll was a magnificent thing. It was, at the auction they had it displayed in a very long glass case with a good portion of it unrolled. But it's, you know, it's a single space paragraph, 120 feet long. It's just amazing. It's beautiful. I hope it'll get to some public institution eventually where people will be able to see it. It really is an American treasure, and it belongs in the Smithsonian or the Byrd collection, instead of which it fell into the hands of a private collector, which was a big disappointment.
Mm. I remember reading On the Road and being intrigued by it and being into all this stuff. And this was in the early 70s when I discovered it, right shortly after he had passed mm-hmm. on. And we all had these romantic notions about him. you had romantic notions about him as well. You would have married him if he'd been into that.
I would have married him, yeah. But I think I also knew, even though I was quite young, in the back of my mind I knew that this relationship was probably not going to be a lasting relationship. That I'd be with him for a while and then I wouldn't be. And that would be okay.
You were with him. You were in his circle when he finally hit it big with On the Road.
That's right.
How did that change him?
Well, it was an overwhelming experience. Of course, he was very excited at first because the book was sort of established overnight with one rave review in the New York Times that made him, Jack, seem the most important writer since Hemingway, and also said that the book was this very important generational statement. So the very next day, there was this rush of media. Everybody wanted to interview Jack. People from newspapers, also from TV. TV was new then, and Jack, I think, was one of the first writers to go on talk shows. And he was totally unprepared for that. And he felt very exposed, embarrassed. He was not an extrovert, not at all. And had a kind of innate shyness. And in order to meet all these obligations and face the public, he began to drink more and more. But then also, increasingly, a lot of the attention he got was extremely hostile and belittling. And people wrote, said terrible things, writes like a slob, running a temperature, this isn't writing, this is typewriting, all kinds of, and he was deeply, deeply hurt by these things. And also by the way he was portrayed personally by the press. And the fact that this whole idea of beat, which had had a really important meaning to him and to Allen Ginsberg and a few other people when they originally coined the phrase, suddenly it became corrupted into beatnik, and anybody could be a beatnik by putting on a goatee and a black beret and getting a set of bongos. You know, he hated that. He really didn't want imitators. So the drinking accelerated, and he got more and more morose. And it also affected his feeling about his work. He'd always turned to his work as a source of joy and ecstasy. And now, when he sat down at the typewriter, he'd have all the voices of those critics in his ears. He began a book during the time that he'd wanted very much to write during the time that I knew him, a book called Memory Babe about his boyhood, and couldn't complete it, said he couldn't remember things, which was odd for him because he had a phenomenal memory.
Which in a way is a curse.
Yeah.
For one more slice of that ecstasy pie.
Right.
I was reminded of what happened to Jackson Pollock in a different medium and how he couldn't deal with the fame.
He couldn't.
And the Life magazine article, and after that.
And the film about him.
The film.
It made him terribly self-conscious.
Started drinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, again.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
So I think if Jack had had the kind, that sort of smaller, more literary success, he might have survived that much better.
Speaking of reviews, that first review that Jack got for On the Road, he was quite fortunate that the normal reviewer was on vacation.
Yeah, the normal reviewer was a very conservative, uptight guy, and he was away. It was around Labor Day. And so the reviewer who got it was a man named Gilbert Milstein, who'd been hearing about the Beats for years and had been tracking them and was very sympathetic to the book.
You were a participant and an observer of so much back in those days, and you discovered a haunt called the Cedar Bar. Tell us about this place. I've read so much about it.
Oh, it was a very important gathering place. It was in the Greenwich Village on 8th Street and University Place. It was a very nondescript, old-fashioned looking place. And it was a gathering. It's been a gathering for many years of a group of abstract expressionist painters, none of whom were very well known, and then who became increasingly famous. Pollock went there, and Willem de Kooning, and Franz Klein, and Philip Guston, And so it became a very important scene, because not only for painters, but a lot of writers started hanging out there, and filmmakers and dancers, and it was just an amazingly gifted group of people all in one little spot at one time.
You also got to know people like Allen Ginsberg. What was he like?
I was always very fond of Allen, and I really still miss him a lot. He was wonderfully kind and generous to his friends. When he was dying, he called up his friends. He called Leroy Jones and said, "I'm dying. Do you need any money?" I mean, you know, that was so typical of Allen, that real sort of sweetness. He was also someone who I think really could have helped Jack through this whole hideous experience of becoming a celebrity if he'd been around at the time. But unfortunately for Jack, that year Allen was away in Paris, so Jack had to go through this all by himself. But Allen could have interpreted it for him and shown him how to deal with the media and taken some of the attention himself. And I think that would have been a good thing for Jack. So he went through it all alone.
What was your impression of William Burroughs?
I only met William Burroughs once, very passingly, when I was 16. And there was a party where William Burroughs passed through this sort of shadowy, slightly sinister figure on his way to Tangier. And I'd heard the story about his...
The William Tell
mm-hmm. story, yeah.
I really was struck by the... honesty and the frankness in these letters. Did you print unexpurgated letters? Were there parts that you took out because you thought that they just weren't interesting? Or
I left out a couple of my own letters just because I felt they were sort of repetitious, but I didn't really tamper with the letters.
As we move deeper into the book, he becomes quite different in his tone. He starts getting kind of nasty towards people like Marlon Brando, and he starts talking about his own abilities. He's talking about his own writing, mm-hmm. and he's very highly praiseful of his own work. Did this seem strange at the time?
Well, he was very wounded by all this, all the critical abuse that he'd received. And he was trying to bolster himself up. He was angry. He was angry, and he was wounded. And that's what sort of came across, I think, in the tone of his letters.
Now, he had a daughter, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is she still around?
No, she died a few years ago, unfortunately.
Okay. Okay.
She died at 47, which was the age at which Jack died.
Oh, my.
Yeah. But he'd never really acknowledged her. And which was, I thought, a terrible shame for both of them.
When he died, what happened with you? Did you expect this to happen at such a young age?
I was shocked, although I always felt that, you know, chances were Jack would die before his time, because I knew about the drinking, and the last time I had seen him, the last time I'd seen him was in 63, when I was married to my first husband, and Jack suddenly called up out of the blue and said he was in New York, and would I come and see him? And I said, well, I'm married, you know, now. And he said, well, bring your little husband. And we went over to see Jack, and I was appalled just by the way he looked. He was all bloated. You know, he was a gorgeous-looking man, but he'd really gone downhill, and he was just blind, angry, drunk by the time we got there, and I'd never seen him that way during the time that I knew him.
And if memory serves, you left when he and another fellow started having a duel with lit cigarettes.
Yeah, that was a good time to leave.
Oh, my. Well, this is quite a snapshot of a time that doesn't seem that long ago, but...
It was long ago, and
yeah.
Very different.
Very different.
Yeah. Although, you know, I mean, I think the books are all still very much alive for people, and that's what makes it all seem almost like yesterday.
Had he lived, What do you think he'd be doing now? He'd be in his late 70s, wouldn't he?
Yep, he'd be around 78, 79. Uh-huh. Last time I did the math, yeah.
Yeah. What do you think he'd be up to?
Hard to say. I think he'd, whatever he was doing, he'd be writing, because that was the most important thing in his life. You know, he wrote every day of his life. He'd get up, record his dreams, write in his notebooks. That was always the most important thing to him, more important than relationships.
And his favorite time to write was Saturday night? At the time, at a certain time?
His, I don't know. His favorite time to write seemed to be all the time. he had, you know, he with On the Road, he had broken through into this new way of spontaneous writing, you know, which he would sort of go forward almost without stopping, although he, you know, he did make some. It's not true that he never revised. He did do a certain amount of revision. But he would write all his, after 1951, he would write all his books in very short periods of time. And those times would be very intense and very ecstatic for him. And after they were over, he would be depressed. He'd be back with himself again.
Now, much has been made over the years, different rumors, different suspicions about him, and you debunk some of these in your book. Are there any in particular that you'd like to address?
Well, there a few years ago, there was a book by a man named Ellis Ambern called Subterranean Kerouac, and the whole thesis of that book was that Jack was gay. And, you know, I think Jack was to some extent bisexual, but he, you know, he was always very interested in women. There was never any question about that. I think, though, that his relationship with his mother made it hard for him to form a lasting bond with a woman. She was always the one lasting bond in his life, and sort of prevented him from maturing emotionally.
I kept getting the image of the mother in Psycho. What I think about her.
Well, she wasn't quite as bad as that, but she was a formidable old lady. She was smart. And on the positive side, I would say that if it weren't for Jack's mother, we might not have all those books that Jack wrote, because they would have just gotten lost, I think, during the period that Jack was traveling. He didn't have anyone else to leave them with. And she all kept all his books and papers for him. They're always there when he, you know, touch base with her.
I think one of the most amazing things about this book, Joyce, is that you were able to read letters that Jack wrote during the same period to other people, where you were able to put together things and see aspects of his personality that he wasn't showing you,
right.
See things that he said about you.
I was in a very unique position.
I thought that was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of the discoveries I made were of course, painful, even, you know, so many years later. But I wanted to get the truest picture of Jack. You know, we're different people with depending on who we're with.
Ultimately, do you think it was the drinking that really did him in?
I think it was the drinking, yeah. And the relationship with his mother. And the whole experience with the media that sort of took away the thing that writing gave him, which was a sense of ecstasy, a sense of balance, you know, strip that away from him too.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook, going back to 2001, my conversation with Joyce Johnson, who dated Jack Kerouac for 2 years in 1957 and 1958. For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.